Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cagliano. And we are in Frank's sunroom. Is that what you would call this?
Yeah, the Brits would call it a conservatory.
Yes, but we don't get much sun here because it's December in Scotland, and it is New Year's Eve. And so this is our New Year's Eve special episode, end of the year 2018, looking forward 2019 special.
It's our bumper holiday edition, David. Come on, you got to big it up, man.
But New Year's is a big holiday here in Scotland, so it's bigger than Christmas in some ways.
Yeah, well, it certainly is big in Edinburgh. I mean, there'll be a million people in town for the street party tonight. What are you doing?
I'm going to sit in my flat and maybe have a glass of whiskey at midnight and watch the fireworks. But I can see the castle from my flat, so I think we're going to do that rather than brave the crowds. Right. Are you going to go out and party all night? Is that what you're doing?
Not all night. I'm actually going to dinner. We always go to dinner with some friends who live very close to you, in fact. And at midnight for the bells, as they say, go out onto the meadows and or actually onto the links and see the fireworks over the castle. And then, I quite like it. I quite like New Year's Eve. I like New Year's Eve here.
Yes.
I would never go down to Prince's Street and do the official street party here, where you're kind of penned in like cattle and you're paying for the privilege to be basically held under lock and key. I wouldn't do that.
All right, so...
I'm a free spirit, David. I have to range.
I understand. Well, I'm kind of sedate, and even if you're the old man in the show, I like a quiet night in sometimes. It's been a long year. And one of the things is coming up, I guess, we want to do two things in this episode. One is we want to talk about sort of the status of the profession at the moment, the status of the sort of career path of historians. We've got the AHA coming up in a few days. This year, I guess it's a joint with the MLA in Chicago, so they're going to fight it out over citation styles or something. We wanted to talk about the status of the profession in particular, about an essay that came out, I believe, in March by Erin Bartram about her relationship, I guess, with the profession. Might be one way of thinking about what that essay is about. But now with the job market and the AHA coming up, might be a good point to reflect on that. To end on the year on a slightly lighter note, we want to give our sort of 10 best of 2018 and some things in 2019 we're looking forward to. All right.
Excellent. Yeah, it's not quite 10. We'll count down and we'll see how many we get.
We got a bunch of things. Yeah, we're not so good with the numbers.
We're not numerate. And we've always said, people, this is kind of a garage band equivalent of a podcast. And so, our top 10 might not be 10 or it might be 11 or who knows.
Who knows, yes. Somebody in the aftermath will have to check our check and see how many we list. All right. But before we get all that, so Frank, you're... have lots of experience thinking about that you've got the long view on the profession. What struck you in reading Erin Bartram's essay, which I imagine many of our listeners have had a chance to see already, but we'll put links to it in the show notes.
Yeah, I mean, so in fact, I read the essay when it came out in the spring, and I reread it this morning, in fact, because it's received a little bit of play on Twitter at the end of the year, I think, because it was one of the most read things at the Chronicle of Higher Education. It originally appeared in Erin's blog, and then it was picked up by the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is essentially our trade paper. And it's a very poignant, eloquent, sad message. It's a valedictory from a young scholar who's basically giving up on the profession, a young historian, because... of the difficulties she's faced, which are not unique to Erin, to be sure, finding a permanent tenure-track job as a young scholar. And it's a very powerful piece of writing that reflects on her decision to leave the profession and her relationship with research. I read the essay, as I said, again this morning and found it very moving. I also made the mistake, you're never supposed to read the comments. I read some of the comments on the essay at the Chronicle website, and they prompted a lot of the essay prompted lots of different responses and a lot of different emotions from myself. ranging from, you know, I'd say the overwhelming sense was of sympathy for Aaron, but also fellow feeling among many other young academics struggling to find full-time employment because of the widespread use of adjuncts to provide teaching in the United States. It's worth saying that although that we haven't had the same level of adjunctification in the UK yet, it's creeping in around the edges.
It is,
you know, and even in the time you've been, the relatively brief time you've been with us, you've probably seen that. It's not quite as widespread as in the US, but it is growing here in the UK. And for those of our listeners who aren't in academia or higher education, adjuncts are essentially people brought in, usually with PhDs, usually young scholars or newly minted scholars, sometimes quite experienced scholars, who are brought in to teach more or less on a piecemeal basis, teaching courses for anywhere from $1,000 to $4,000, they're working long hours for very poor pay and very few or no benefits as a rule.
Yeah.
And often the people who are doing this are doing it at multiple institutions or teaching multiple courses at the same institution or across several institutions. It's very, very difficult. It's very heavy teaching load. And it's something that was certainly when I went on the job market now over 25 years ago, people did, but you did it as a kind of transition to getting or hopefully getting a more permanent and better paid position. There were people who got trapped as permanent adjuncts even then, but it seems much more widespread now. So that's the kind of background to this. I don't know whether you want to... Well, you've been in higher education in the U.S. more recently than me.
Yeah, so you've seen a tremendous growth, I think, number of adjuncts over the past 10 or 12 years in particular. I mean, I think the roots of it go back much before that, but I think universities are recognizing that adjuncts are in some ways much cheaper than permanent members of staff, tenured track or tenured members of staff. And so it's easier to get their teaching filled by adjuncts. And in part because there are so many people looking for work, people are willing to take these not particularly good jobs in terms of the financial compensation. Because the alternatives aren't there.
Did you ever adjunct?
I adjuncted briefly. I defended in December, and then I spent a semester adjuncting to two different schools. But then I was very lucky at that point and got a tenure track job. But that was more because of luck than anything else, I think. I know lots of people who were in graduate school with me who ended up in adjuncting positions of a variety of kinds, you know, and not only initially and then getting a tenure track position, but some of them people who have been in adjuncting jobs of a variety of kinds for 10 years now. And I've known people who have been in permanent adjuncting jobs, sometimes working in multiple institutions for, decades almost. And it's it's very hard to get from those kinds of positions into tenured positions. I think oftentimes the way these were sold 10, 20 years ago was that it was a stepping stone to a tenure track position. But if a university knows that they can basically keep you on as an adjunct, there's very little incentive for universities to make those permanent positions.
Why has this happened? Why is I have my own idea, so to some extent I'm throwing this out as a rhetorical question, David. But I mean, again, to explain for our listeners, especially those who aren't in higher education, why this change has occurred.
Yeah. So I think some of it has to do with the economics of it. You know, what used to happen was that a senior academic would retire and then that would, open up a slot in sort of the bottom end of the tenure track ladder, or sometimes two slots in the bottom end of the tenure track ladder, for new people to come in as permanent members of staff. Increasingly, I think universities are pinched in terms of finances, or claiming that they're pinched in terms of finances, which may or may not be reflect the actual economics of it. Investing in a tenure track or permanent member of staff, this is a very big investment. And if you can get a person doing essentially the same work for less money, it makes a lot of sense from the university's perspective to do that. In the long term, though, I think that's, you know, it's a mistake for universities to do that, for a number of reasons. One, it's not fair to the people that you're hiring to make them do all this work at doing the same work that permanent members of staff are doing, but at a much lower pay rate. I don't think that's fair. It's not particularly fair to the students if they develop a relationship with an academic in 1 year of their study, and then all of a sudden the person's gone next year because that line has run out. You know, which is could have consequences for who's going to write letters of recommendation for them, who's going to mentor them, all other kinds of things. You know, if you're in one of these jobs, it's very hard to, you know, have time to do research to get a permanent position, because oftentimes permanent positions are hired based on research performance. And if you are teaching 4, 5, 6, 7 classes in a semester at 2 institutions and spending all of your free time, your time not teaching on the interstate going between institutions, or on the train if you're in the UK, you know, that doesn't leave time for actual research, and research time, even for, you know, permanent members of staff, is at a premium, but it's especially tricky for people who are, whose employment is tenuous. And being on the market every year is a full-time job in itself, that for people who are in one-year positions and they know they have to apply for another position, that's going to eat up any time they could be using for, you know, real engagement with research. And so it's a system that is, not in the best interest of the students. It's not in the best interest of the people doing the teaching. But it's a system that, at least in the short term, makes sense financially.
The responses to Aaron's essay that I read this morning ran the gamut from, and I'd say sympathy was the most prominent one. But so there was sympathy expressed by both senior scholars who are in full-time posts like ourselves, but also fellow adjuncts and PhD students expressed sympathy for her and support for her decision to leave the profession. But there were other sentiments expressed as well. There was a lot of animus expressed towards university administrators as the so-called authors of this new policy, it's not a new policy, but this transition. So universities have increasingly been taken over by people at the top level who have basically are management experts or alleged experts rather than academics. And that they've made these cost-cutting, they've adopted cost-cutting measures and so on. So on one hand, the blame was kind of placed at the feet of administrators. On the other, in a minority view, several senior academics said, well, it's not quite like that. And a lot of senior administrators at universities are actually senior academics at universities. And the picture is more complicated than that. But there was a lot of blame being laid at the feet of administrators collectively. And I have some sympathy for that. And certainly in the 26 years now that I've been in the UK, the rise of a kind of managerial class within universities, a professional managerial class, is pronounced, and it's changed British higher education in profound ways. And I think there's a similar development going on in the US. So that was part of it. There was a sort of grumpy old guard, not exclusively male, but predominantly male, that more or less said, oh, suck it up. It was tough for us. It's tough for you. It's supposed to be tough because it's a meritocracy. Again, I'd be interested to hear your response to that. And there were others, more experienced academics, both male and female, who were expressing views saying, yes, it has always been like this, but it's always been bad. And we need to change this system, and it's more acute now than ever. So there were kind of at least three responses. I'm sure there were more, but those were the three that kind of stuck with me. And I'd be interested in your response to those. The one thing that did strike me in reading this was thinking more broadly about changes in the culture. I'm thinking about Uber and the kind of rise of the gig economy. And I wonder if, although the rise of the adjuncts has been a long-term trend, and it was going on well before what we now call the gig economy, but if it's not now a piece of that, where it's similar, where no young people have job security. I exaggerate for effect, but in many professions,
going through multiple career changes is the norm.
Yeah. Is the norm, and there's a great deal of uncertainty. And you don't necessarily have benefits, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And so what Aaron was writing about with regard to higher education would be entirely familiar to people of, you know, her age and younger in other fields. Mm. So that's a bigger philosophical point, I think. But yeah. I'd be interested to hear your response to those responses, as it were.
Well, I mean, one of the things that makes academia slightly different than most aspects of the gig economy is the amount of time you have to invest in it before you consider to be a member of the guild.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, we are medieval in our approach.
Yeah, you know, so if you have spent, after your undergraduate degree, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 years of apprenticeship before you're admitted into the guild, you know, then not being able to actually act in the, you know, do the thing you're trained for, because there aren't jobs out there. That it's, I think, a very different. I think there's a disconnect between sort of the gig economy model of, oh, you can sort of transition something else and do things in a piecemeal fashion, which doesn't, you know, reflect the fact that somebody has invested a huge amount of time and mental and emotional energy into something. You know, there was a point, I think, in which the job market was better, or and I think that might have been in the, you know, 1950s and 1960s. There was a point in which, you know, the baby boomers are going to college in record numbers, and so the demand for people to teach them went up pretty dramatically. You have a democratization of higher education that happens both in the U.S. and the U.K. in the, you know, 30, 40-year period after the Second World War. And
the top rate of taxation was much higher, too, so there was better funding for higher education.
So, you know, then I think if you are finishing a PhD in, you know, 1963 and, you know, you need a job, there are jobs out there. One of the sort of myths that's been going around, and it's myths that I heard, you know, when I started graduate school, and myths you probably heard too, was eventually that generation of people will retire.
I was told that in 1987.
Yes, you know, and so, and I, those people,
the boom is coming.
Well, and I don't think it is.
No, I agree, but we were told that.
And I think we knew when I heard that. I think we knew that was a lie. I mean, that didn't happen for a number of reasons. Partially having to do with the economy going bad in 2008, so lots of people held off retirement. Part of it having to do with the demographics, the number of people who are going to university and the number of people who are getting PhDs. There are
far more people getting PhDs now than in 1963.
Yes. And universities are encouraging people to get PhDs. You know, we are, as academics, encouraged to take on PhD students and to graduate PhD students.
Do we take too many?
We, meaning you and me, or we as a profession?
Well, both had. I mean, I will say I have a prepared speech for every prospective PhD student that I meet, telling them not to do this and telling them why they shouldn't do it. They almost always ignore that speech because...
Well, they think they're the exception, and
they do. Well,
and in many cases, we were the exception, and that's why.
That's right. I mean, the number, you know, they will often say, "But you got a job," and I say, "Well, I'm a lot older than you." And secondly, I was lucky, and the world has changed. Or they'll say, "I want your job," and I usually say, "Well, I have my job."
They're like, "But you're going to retire soon, Frank. That's what we're going to."
But I do worry. Yeah. I do worry that we train too many PhDs. I mean, the PhD students I've trained thus far, you know, and they're wonderful people and wonderful scholars, and I've loved supervising them, and several of them have done very well. But I do worry that we train too many, and that's not a comment on any of them as individuals, because it's not a comment on you and I as individuals, but as a system, when you think about the number of jobs there are out there and the number of PhDs we're training each year.
Yeah, well, it's the tragedy of the commons problem in some ways. We all individually have an incentive to accept lots of PhD students, train lots of PhD students, hopefully get our PhD students good jobs afterwards. but we're collectively making it harder for everybody as a consequence. When I taught North Dakota, the AHA Perspectives came out with an article with a list of 10 PhD programs they thought should close because they were simply producing, you know, on the, along the line of this argument of having too many PhD students. One of the ones they listed was at the university I was teaching at, and their argument was, like, North Dakota doesn't need a PhD program. And that year, I think we increased the size of the number of PhD students we had in the year that, you know, the flagship magazine of the profession said we shouldn't have a program at all. And the sort of local incentives for why doing that were important, it mattered to the state legislature how many PhD programs we had. And people were rewarded accordingly. So, what's the way out of this then?
Well, sorry, before we do that,
because I'm not sure I have the answer to that. So this is delaying activity. What do you think of the response? I asked you your response to the responses. I don't know what you think of those. Yeah. So,
I mean, I can only have just a tremendous amount of sympathy for anybody who's finding this job market traumatic. Because it's a very hard market. Everybody who is, you know, interviewing for a job at the AHA, good luck to all of you. All of you deserve to get those jobs you are applying for. All of you are smart enough. All of you are, you know, have done all the things that the profession has asked of you in terms of getting fellowships and writing articles and book proposals and all that kind of stuff, right? And ultimately, who ends up getting jobs and who ends up not getting jobs is much a product of luck and happenstances that is based on talent. I mean, I think one of the myths that academia has is it's a meritocracy and that the people who are the smartest and work hardest will be rewarded for their efforts. And that's just not true necessarily. That there are lots of people who do everything right and who still don't get jobs. And there's lots of people who, for whatever reason, other reasons, sometimes do end up getting jobs. And so, you know, I think it was very brave of Aaron to sort of write this piece and to sort of allow the Chronicle to republish it, because I think it's speaks, I mean, part of the reason why this article was read so much was because it speaks to so many people's experience with a market that is not particularly humane and doesn't, treat its applicants very well. And the particular, the job market in the UK and the US is different in terms of the way the cycle works and all these other kinds of things. But going to the AHA is hard. I mean,
it's awful.
It's an expensive city the week after Christmas, and you get notified that you're going to have to go there, 2 weeks beforehand. And it's not a particularly pleasant experience for anybody, unless it's in New Orleans, in which case it's a pleasant experience, but not because of the AHA. So the people who are critical of her saying it's always hard and if you're smart enough, you'll get a job, that's nonsense. I mean, I think that speaks to the kind of both privilege and amnesia that comes with not being on the market. And the market is now always harder than it was 25 years ago, I think. And the market 25 years ago was very hard.
Right, I think that's true. I think you're right. Yeah.
So, in the kinds of things that people need to do now in order to distinguish themselves from the other 200 excellent applicants for a job, is quite profound. You know, the people who are coming out of graduate school who have publications and have a social media following and have a blog and do, have a pod, they're doing like lots of stuff.
And stuff we didn't have to do.
No. I mean, it used to be you had to graduate. You had to
have a degree in publications.
and a nice letter from your supervisor saying that, you know, Frankie's a very smart boy, you should give him a job. Everybody has those letters now and has the sort of basic things. And so it's a really very competitive, you know, marketplace that tends to chew people up and spit them out.
It's an irony that a profession, that our profession, and I'm not talking about history in particular now, but academia more generally, where many people, not all, but many people would consider themselves enlightened and I think left of center. I wouldn't necessarily subscribe to the Fox News view that all universities are filled with Marxists seeking to indoctrinate people. But in general, I would say I think the center of gravity is probably left of center. Has such appalling, it treats its workforce in such an appalling fashion. And exploits the new members of the profession in such a way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just irony is one word for it, but it's just something that I occasionally reflect on. I think as far as your question about what the answer is, there is no simple answer to this. There's no question about that. It seems to me there are several things. I mean, there are big macro things. So it'd be great if taxes, at least in the U.S., went up again and there was greater public investment in education. I think that will happen eventually, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. Mm. And I don't, you know, and that's a long-term structural issue. But in terms of steps that can be taken, both by prospective academics and newly minted PhDs, and steps anybody can take, I guess. One, I think that organizing and industrial action would actually be useful. I think if adjuncts unionized, as they've attempted to do, and in some cases been successful at in certain institutions, they should do so because the system relies on them to such an extent. I think undergraduates should complain to their institutions about the number of adjuncts who are teaching them, not because those adjuncts are doing a bad job, but the students have incredible power.
And they don't realize it,
but I think students could put pressure on their own institutions to see that the people who teach them are well treated. And I think that would be useful. I think we can get out of the way. You know, we're in the privileged position of having permanent jobs, the equivalent of tenure or tenure track jobs here in the UK. Tenure in the US since doesn't exist here anymore, but effectively that's what we have. You know, so I'm not going to hang on after an appropriate retirement age blocking a space because I think I have a obligation to graduate students in a few years' time to create space and get out of the way. It's not to say you stop being a scholar. In fact, one of the great things about our profession is you don't have to retire in the kind of conventional sense. But I think senior people need to get out of the way and allow younger colleagues the opportunity to have their own careers. Those of us who've been fortunate enough to have them, I think that's something that can be done. Mm. Now, there's a crucial difference between the U.S. and UK, or the UK and U.S. in this regard, which is you and I can retire without worrying about things like our health care and coverage. Yeah. So there are people hanging on to jobs in the U.S., not because they want to make life difficult for adjuncts or newly minted PhDs, but because they're hanging on to keep their health insurance coverage. And that's a whole other discussion, of course, but that's not a problem we face here in the U.K. Mm. And so I would qualify that slightly and say within reason people should, where possible, open up opportunities for younger scholars. The danger, of course, is that, you know, if senior people retire and then there is a generation gap in some of this debate, that's a little nasty. But where that's the case, you know, universities might make savings. So when I retire in a few years' time, maybe the university won't replace me. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying
they'll replace you with two adjuncts.
Right, exactly. Who are much cheaper, and so that is a danger. But I think adjuncts and young scholars need to organize. I think students need to put pressure on their institutions, and I think senior scholars who are in the enviable position of having posts like we enjoy need to help where we can,
but also get out of the way when appropriate.
Yeah.
And finally, I think we also need to have a discussion about the number of PhD students we train, which is a hard discussion to have with our institutions, which have a financial incentive in training more PhD students. We rely on the labor of those students.
Yes, we do.
But, you know, there is a question to be had. And we also need to, there was a lot of discussion about so-called ALT-AC, alternative academic careers. We're the wrong people to give advice about that
because we don't academic careers. Exactly, so
But there are many people I follow on Twitter, Aaron Bartram's one of them, who I have seem to do this quite successfully. Mm-hmm. But they are, we need to find out what that means. And as I said, we're in a particularly bad place to do that ourselves. But institutions need to find a way
to connect with those people to help train our PhD students to have the skills
they need. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're not the right people to do that because we haven't had ALT-AC careers. I'm thinking of our mutual friend Liz Covert, who's really become a very important figure in the profession because of her podcast. And not using a podcast, but she's a podcaster. Mm. And she's engaged in public history and in a really profound way that has a huge influence. But she basically did that herself.
Yes.
And so we need Liz to share her wisdom. Not that everybody's going to follow that path.
We all need so many podcasts. But
right. Yes. Clearly. but Liz is a good example of somebody who did that herself.
Yes.
But we need to institutionalize that, not to keep having more podcasts necessarily, but to institutionalize.
The future is not in podcasting. It's not. You're not going to be able to pay the bills with the podcast. Liz might be able.
Liz might be able to, but we're not. but that kind of basically what Liz did in the context of the humanities was essentially create a successful startup. Mm. And as academic institutions, we need to facilitate that kind of activity for our students. Not just pay lip service to ALT-AC and say, "Oh, you might think about museums," which you might think about, but
actually have people who know things about museums.
Think more creatively about it. So I think that's another aspect of this. But I don't see an easy solution because I do think if with the rise of the gig economy, the world has changed. The notion of a tenured job that you keep your entire life is
a very 20th century notion.
It is a 20th century notion. Built on a system of supervision and training that's medieval, frankly. Exactly, yes. So we need to retool, I think, for the 21st. Or the profession needs to. I'm too old. you laugh now, David. Soon you'll be too old. But, what we can do is express sympathy and give support to our students, and when the time comes, get out of the way.
I guess the only piece of advice I've got to people going into this whole thing is cast a wide net and look in places you wouldn't expect to look. There's,
look abroad.
Look internationally. There are, I wouldn't say there are lots of jobs internationally, but there are jobs internationally that are, good jobs. And people, especially if you do American history, there's interest in American history everywhere in the world right now. And I think there are jobs out there if you're willing to, pack up and move to Turkey or to China or to India or to Japan. I think
Scotland.
Or to Scotland. Yes, there are jobs. I'm not sure about that. Are you retiring tomorrow? there's lots of places to look for jobs that people might not think to look if they're, when they're first getting on the market.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So best of luck to everyone going to the AHA. Stay warm, Chicago, in January.
Be nice to each other.
Yes.
You're in competition. Of course you're in competition, but you're not really in competition because the chances are so slim anyway.
Jeez.
That's not on that cheerful note. Yes. When did you last interview for jobs at the AHA?
The year I got the job here.
Right.
Yeah. I went to the AHA several times.
Have you been back?
No. I might go again next year because it's in New York, but that's as much because it's in New York and I've got family than anything else. All right. So, 2018, Frank. What artifacts of 2018? We both got a list of approximately 10, give or take some.
Yeah. Depends on how you count.
So we're counting now, kind of, and we confine this more or less to history and history-related things. Although I think we define these, particularly in my case, somewhat broadly.
Well,
My and these are not in order of importance, but they're kind of in the order I thought of them. My first or my 10th, I don't know how you
get,
is just last week we marked the 25th anniversary of the Getting Word project at Monticello. And for people who don't know, Getting Word began in 1993 as a project to identify the descendants of enslaved people who worked at Monticello, lived and worked at Monticello, and interview them to find out what their family oral traditions were about this. And the project has grown over the past 25 years. It was started by two wonderful historians, Diane Swan Wright, who's unfortunately now deceased, and Cinder Stanton. Cinder is a wonderful historian and was for a long time a research historian at Monticello. There was a huge amount about the operation of Monticello as a plantation and slavery at Monticello. And Cinder and Diane really got this project going with the support of the then president of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, Dan Jurdon, in 1993. They've since interviewed more than 200 people, identified them around the world.
Really?
Yep. Some people who didn't realize they were descended from enslaved people in Monticello and others who did. They have an archive of more than 200 interviews. You can, if you go to Getting Word on the Monticello website, there's a website for it. There's an archive and there are extracts from some of the interviews that I would really commend to you. This is a wonderful, wonderful project, and it's a great example of public history. It's a great example of the fact that Monticello is not just the home of Thomas Jefferson. It's one of the best preserved plantations we have, and it's a wonderful resource. The project is now being directed and run by a fabulous young historian named Naya Bates, and Naya is really smart and really she's got tons of energy, and she can articulate why this is important in such a powerful way. And Naya is a UVA grad, but also a Charlottesville native.
Oh,
so and you know, she understands the community and understands why this is important. And it's just a wonderful thing. And I look forward to the next 25 years of it. But my first is acknowledging the 25th anniversary of Getting Word. So happy birthday,
great.
Getting Word, and onwards and upwards. What's yours?
Okay, so my 10th, I think it's something, we got some things, we compared notes beforehand, and we got some
things. Well, we came up with our list separately but we have several things that are the same.
All right, so my number 10 is the second season of Slow Burn, which I think is also on your list.
Yes, this is where our lists are going to, yes, that's on my list as well. This was the one that was about the Clinton scandals.
Right, so the first season of Slow Burn, if I think maybe you probably listened to this was about, the first season was about Watergate, and the second season did a similar model where they tried to sort of piece apart the Clinton scandals of various kinds, but you know, Monica Lewinsky et al. And you know, in some ways, that was a story I thought I knew really well, but this made me rethink some things I had already thought I'd come to conclusions about, and it made me sort of reconsider the Bill Clinton's actions, his presidency. I had, I guess, previously been at least back in the 90s, defended Bill Clinton, where in retrospect, maybe I shouldn't have.
Yeah, it was on my list as well. And I agree with you. I love the first season of Slow Burn when it was about Watergate. And I was a little bit skeptical about the second season. I thought, oh, I remember all that. I know that. I lived through that. Well, I didn't remember nearly as much as I thought. And you're right. The episode with Juanita Broderick concerning that incident, it makes it very... Bill Clinton... Well, anyway, I would commend that episode, well, the whole series to people, but that episode in particular, in light of Me Too, but not just that, it takes on a rather different cast. And it's very difficult to think of Bill Clinton in the same way after you... It's not a hatchet job on Bill Clinton. It's a very good documentary series. But It's, well, Bill Clinton's legacy is complicated. I think that's the best thing we can say for it. And there are parts of it which are really, well, sinister.
Yeah.
It makes for hard listening if you supported Bill Clinton. And then, I mean, I remember having a huge fight with my brother over Bill Clinton in the 90s because I was slightly more skeptical than he was, particularly about this issue. But it's complicated stuff. And Slow Burn does it. It's a good example of the kind of quality journalism and kind of documentary making that can be done using the podcast. The podcast as a medium, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I really liked about it was the way in which they both took archival material from the 90s, but then also contemporary interviews with some of the participants, you know, looking and having the perspective that we now have on sexual harassment, on gender relations in the workplace, and on the Clinton administration more broadly. I don't know whether they're planning on doing a season 3. I hope they are. I'm not quite sure what they pick, but we'll see.
Well, depending on, and I know this is going to be a largely Trump-free episode, and I'm happy about that, but depending on how the Trump presidency goes, they might have plenty of material in the future.
Yeah, the subtext for both seasons, I think, really was the Trump presidency. You know, it's one of these things where they're talking about it without talking about it. All right, so we had that one in common. I guess I'll go again with another one. Another innovation of 2018 that I hope sticks around for a while is Historians at the Movies, which I think you've endorsed in the previous episode, which was created by the guy who sort of runs it, is a PhD student, Jason Herbert, where basically they pick a movie every, I think it's every week basically, to have historians analyze the movie from a, you know, with the expertise that we bring to it. And sometimes they pick very serious movies, you know, historical sort of docudrama kinds of things, and sometimes they pick some more lighthearted fare to analyze.
Yeah, this happens on Twitter in that they watch the movie at approximately the same time and tweet about it.
Yeah, my only complaint about Historians at the Movies is that it is not conducive if you are not in the United States to participate.
That's true. It's like, there are just, you know, you can't watch the Oscars if you don't. Well, you can, but, you know, it's on the middle of the night. Yeah. There are things you miss. If you...
I'm an old man. I need to go to bed at midnight.
Right, that's true, but there's no reason that European historians or British historians can't go to the movies themselves.
Oh, that's true, yes. I mean, to be sure.
It's a hashtag.
Yes, it is. But it's a really, I think it's a fun way of...
It's a great idea, and it's...
Engaging with the public and you know, talking about things that are both drawing our expertise, but also having a good time.
And you know what? Academic Twitter is good, and I like it a lot, but it can also be quite self-referential and self-reverential.
Yes.
And a little sanctimonious. And Historian at the Movies is, as you say, it's academic Twitter at its best because it's usually funny. It's very funny, but it's also reaching out to a broader audience. So yeah. I think I agree with you. It's on your list, but I would endorse that.
All right, what else are you
got? Well, next on my list, I think number 9 would be the Boston Red Sox winning the World Series.
Oh, Jesus Christ. So why is this historic?
It's historic because it happened.
Okay.
Okay.
Everything so that happened doesn't make it historic.
Yeah, but it happened and it made me happy.
Oh, okay. So that's
and,
the definition.
And I would argue, I would submit, we are not a sports podcast, but we could do a sports history podcast if we want to. I would submit to you, you're a Yankee fan, so you don't want to hear this. I would submit to you that arguably the 2018 Boston Red Sox are the best Boston Red Sox team of all time. And they've been playing as the Boston Red Sox since 1903.
Yes.
When they joined the American League, and I think this is the best team. The only competition is the 1912 team, which won 105 games in the regular season and then went on to win the World Series 4-3. But this team won more games than any other Red Sox team in the regular season, winning 108, and swept through the playoffs, beating the Yankees, Astros, and Dodgers, arguably the three best teams in baseball other than themselves, in quite a dominating fashion, top to bottom. And this was, you know, previous championship Red Sox championship teams. And I hope Liz Kovart listens to this because Liz is a Red Sox season ticket holder. Previous Red Sox championship teams of this century. haven't always been terribly likable. They've had likable characters, but they've had strong personalities. I mean, it's very hard to look at the 2014 now and not see Kurt Schilling. And Kurt Schilling's become an internet troll of the first order. And he's just a loathsome person. And that's kind of ruined 2004 for me, although it can't ruin it completely. This team doesn't seem to have anybody like that. Now, we'll have to see how it plays out. But it was a likable team. It was a good team. And it's arguably the best Red Sox team in history. So there's the history angle for you. I will submit that.
Okay.
And that's my number 9.
All right. Well, you know, the Red Sox are always very good in the first two decades of any century.
I know that.
The other 8 decades, not so much.
Yes, you're going to win 27 more championships now in the next 80 years.
That's good. Things to look forward to. All right.
But anyway, that was very gracious of you, David. You didn't say anything too snotty about it. So.
They were a good team. They played well, and that's good.
Okay, I'm pushing my luck.
I'm like not one of those like Yankee fans who hates the Red Sox because the Red Sox are evil. I mean, the Red Sox are evil, but you know, if they play well, you should reward people for doing good
work. I want to say something to you about the Yankees, though.
You can say
so. See, this is it. I just complimented you for being gracious. And now, in true masshole Bostonian fashion, yes. I am not going to be gracious because we're terrible winners, as we've demonstrated throughout the first decade of 2 decades of this century. We being New Englanders.
Yes.
Rooting for the an Italian friend of mine once said with regard to an Italian, a prominent Italian football team. Rooting for them is like rooting for capitalism. I would submit to you that rooting for the Yankees is like rooting for capitalism. And giving your politics, you betray yourself by rooting for the Yankees. Anyway, move on. What's next on your list?
Wait, all sports teams' owners are like capitalists, though. Is there a team that's being run by socialists that I'm not aware of?
No. Then also, yeah, but actually, I thank God for the Yankees because it means as long as the Yankees exist, the Red Sox are plucky underdogs.
Even
though they've got as much money. Anyway,
yes.
So carry on. They're all plutocrats.
Yes. I had the...
You've lost your
Well, I had the fortune in the 80s of getting to meet George Steinbrenner, which was an experience. He reminds me of certain other people at the moment. Anyway, feeding up on the podcast endorsement theme... from before, I want to endorse a Slate podcast called Standoff.
Oh, that was great. I did listen to it.
This is one of these sort of short, it's not sort of a running podcast. I think there were only
6 episodes.
Four or six. Yeah. It was not very long. It was sort of like a British television series. It was just sort of, you know, episodic, but with a clear terminus to it. And it's about the Ruby Ridge standoff, which I had been aware of, but didn't really know very much about. And I think actually sort of fits in well with the slow burn in terms of having this event that we're familiar with from the 90s. We know sort of more or less what happened. But this really sort of takes it apart both from the perspective of the federal agents and from the family in the compound. And looks at not only how the events unfolded, but the ways in which the media, when they covered Ruby Ridge at the time, got most of the story wrong. And the lasting effect that Ruby Ridge had on right-wing ideology, on the fringe movements of American politics, and the ways in which those then, I think, still have currency today. I think there's ways in which you can understand Ruby Ridge in the 90s helps to explain some of the things that have happened.
Certainly energized the anti-government movement, that kind of right-wing, now white supremacist, the militia movement.
It's grown.
Yeah.
It's gone from being a very fringe thing to somewhat less.
Although, David, what you say has made me think, I wonder if the 90s in particular aren't particularly fruitful for this kind of coverage, because... Most of the participants, many of the participants are still alive, so they can be interviewed.
Yes.
As you say, it's within the memory of adults of various ages, including ourselves.
Yes.
Despite the vast gap in our ages. So it's suited to this. I mean, so when you talk about slow burn, the next season of slow burn should be the 2000 election controversy.
Oh God, do we have to live through that?
Again, we lived through it, but again, if what slow burn or standoff teach us is things we thought we knew a lot about, we don't know as much or remember as much as we think.
Okay,
and so I think there's I wonder if that time period is exactly suited, and there's audio, there's tons of audio or video available, of course, to use as well. But if it's not well suited, and 20 years is about right to give us historical perspective as well.
I think that's right, yeah.
So anyway, I just say that because you're right. I mean, I Slow Burn was on my list. I didn't have Stand Off, but I could have. Yes. I really enjoyed listening to that, so I agree with you on that. So great. That's great.
What else you got?
I'm gonna take three together to speed things up.
No, if that's okay. All right. That's good.
These are three American history books I really enjoyed this year for different reasons. One is Sarah Churchwell's Behold America, The Entangling History of America First and the American Dream. And in that, Sarah, who teaches at the University of London, basically looks at the history of these two tropes, America First and the American Dream, and their interrelation. It's a really, really sophisticated and engaging book, and a really, really good argument. And it's well argued and well researched, and it's couldn't be more germane. So I think that's really, really good. I'm writing a book right now that's George Washington is one of the main protagonists.
Okay.
And I've spent a lot of time with Colin Calloway's new book, The Indian World of George Washington, which is about George Washington's relationship and interdependence with and killing of Native Americans. And it's a fabulous
book. That's on my to-do. Yeah,
it's a great book. It's a great book. And finally, and I think you have this on your list as well, I really enjoyed my friend Joanne Freeman's book, Field of Blood, which is about violence in Congress and the road to the Civil War. I think we've mentioned this in the past on the podcast. It's a wonderful book. And Joanne is coming to give the Fennell Lecture here in Edinburgh on March 21st, we'll be discussing the book. But those were three books that really stood out, so I'm taking three together.
Okay, well, I'm going to take two together then. Okay. And one of them is Joanne's book, which I'm very excited. It's a wonderful book. It's a book that she's been working on, I want to say, for
17 years.
17 years. That's a, and the book reflects, I think, the time and effort she put into understanding the role of violence, the way in which that sort of shaped 19th century politics. It's a great read as well as an important piece of scholarship, and I'm really looking forward to hearing her talk about it, I guess, in a few months.
Yep.
The other book I want to endorse is Martha Jones' Birthright Citizens, which I've endorsed in the podcast before. It's about African Americans' quest for citizenship in the 19th century and the roots of the 14th Amendment. And the reason why I'm pairing these two is that Martha Jones is also speaking here at the University of Edinburgh, but she's doing so in about 2.5 weeks. Right, so we're having two, I think, really important historians to talk about. And the interesting thing about both these books, I think, is they have a political currency to them that maybe the authors weren't anticipating when they started these projects. One of the things that Joanne Freeman talks about in a book is basically, all these congressmen are armed. They are stabbing each other or threatening to stab each other in the hallways of Congress. And I think when she started that book, Congress was slightly more functional than it is now, and thinking about sort of the political divisions of the mid-19th century and the political divisions of today are quite pressing. Martha Jones's book came out basically the same time that Trump said, oh, well, we can get rid of birthright citizenship, which, probably did wonders for her book sales, but horrors for everything else. And so I'm very excited about the ways in which both of these books are speaking to the present moment. And they're both really well written, so highly endorse both of those.
Yeah, I would agree. And with regard to their timeliness, let me put it to you this way, the length of time it took Joanne to write her book and its sudden timeliness. Joanne's book speaks to the need, there's a slow food movement. I think we need a slow scholarship movement. Joanne's book, and it's not that Joanne has been idle in the past 17 years, the contrary. I mean, she's active in so many ways, but has been productive as a scholar in so many ways during the intervening years. But I think, and in the culture of higher education in the UK, this isn't allowed, basically. This research excellence framework, which we have, the REF, precludes spending 17 years writing a book. But I think Joanne's case is a good example of taking one's time. Mm. And one could make the case for slow scholarship as well as slow food. And you don't know what will be timely when you start a project.
No.
And to some extent, we shouldn't worry about what's going to be timely. I don't know how long Sarah Churchwell spent on her book, but it's very timely now. And looking at America First, but I suspect she was working on it well before.
Yes.
You know, the current moment. Given how
slow publication process is.
And so I think we should take a moment and praise slowness.
Yes, I think there's a virtue to slowness that...
Again, academic Twitter is all about speed and responding to things, and I admire the people on the so-called Twitter historians who are very effective, and I marvel at them somewhat. And Joanna's one of them, interestingly. Yeah. But that's not the same thing as scholarship. It's a form of public engagement, but it's not the same thing as doing scholarship. And I think both the books, all five of the books we've mentioned, are testimony to the importance of good scholarship, which is painstaking.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I would like to recommend, and again, I'm going to take these two together, just two of the best books I read this year in the non-historical category. Well, they're historical in that they both happen to be works set in the past. And I've mentioned them both, I think, as last drops during the course of the past year, but I really enjoyed both of them. And in reflecting, I went back and looked at the list of books I've read this year, and these were two that I really, really enjoyed. Sebastian Barry, the Irish writer's Days Without End, which is about the United States in the 19th century and an Irish immigrant, and he gets involved in the Civil War and the frontier and cross-dressing. There's a lot of stuff going on in Days Without End, and I can recommend it to you strongly. And the other one is Thomas Mullen's Darktown, which is, I read a lot of detective fiction. This was one of the best I've read in a long time, and it's a book about the first African-American police officers in Atlanta right after the Second World War. I think it's 1948, it's set in. And it's a great kind of detective story, but it's also just a great novel about what it was like to be a black police officer in Atlanta during the age of Jim Crow.
Okay.
So, what do you have?
So I want to endorse, as I've mentioned before, Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon, which is arguably in some ways both her first and her last book, because it was one of the first things that she wrote, but it was only published this year. And it's the a narrative of one of the last living former slaves in the United States. And she does a series of interviews with him and talks about his experience in slavery and afterwards. And it's really interesting. It's not a very long book, but it's very well written, and I'm very glad it's seen the light of day after being in the archives for 75 years. So if you haven't read Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon, I really recommend it. It's really, I mean, it's reading the accounts of former slaves. There's obviously hundreds of those that people can read, you know, in WPA interviews and what have you, but this one I think has some very particular merit to it. So take a look at it.
Okay, good.
What else you got?
I want to talk about George W. Bush.
Oh, George W.
Bush is passing. We never did a pod on this.
No, I think that's because we were traveling.
I was on the road when he died, and I think this was a good thing because I think we should mark the passing of George W. Bush. George W. Bush was an incredibly important figure in 20th century American history, American history in the second half of the 20th century. I mean, given the number of roles, public roles he had, and also he was the father of a very significant president himself. So I think his passing is worthy of comment. But I also want to comment on the commentary, which I found very interesting. There was a kind of outpouring of quite sympathetic coverage of George W. Bush and his life when he passed. And to some extent, that's to be expected. That is what civilized human beings do when somebody dies. There was a bit of a backlash at the time because I think it should be said that George W. Bush's legacy is complicated. He voted against the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Willie Horton Act in 1988 signaled a turn in Republican politics that one can argue led us to this moment. I mean, the legacy is complicated. the relatively tepid response to the AIDS crisis.
That's to put it mildly.
Yes. Well, all of these things are complications for his legacy. He deserves some credit, too. I mean, I think his handling of the end of the Cold War was really, really pretty deft. If you read his the only kind of quasi-memoir he wrote with Brett Scowcroft, A World Transformed, it's quite detailed on how they handled that movie. You know, he didn't gloat, he didn't spike the ball in the end zone, all those sorts of things, which could have complicated that moment and possibly been quite destabilizing. But even his foreign policy is complicated. Yes, there's the invasion of Panama and so on. So I would say his legacy is complicated, but what interests me is, as a historian, I guess, is what do we do or say when a major historical figure dies? We had a little bit of this with John McCain, for example, whose legacy, too, was a little bit complicated. On one hand, there's the reflexive, sympathetic human response of, well, don't speak ill of the dead and say nice things about people and emphasize. And to some extent, that's what we do. When is it okay to criticize? When is it, you know, what's the suitable period of time? I think the reason I'm glad we didn't have a podcast on this is I think we would have been pretty critical.
I think we would have been very.
Yeah, no, but I'm not sure that necessarily would have been the appropriate response in the days after somebody dies. No. But is it okay 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 3 years? No,
Frank, the thing about not speaking ill of the dead is you don't speak ill of the dead when, you know, your Uncle Kevin, who was, you know, an alcoholic and you know, didn't treat his children very well. You know, when a private citizen dies, you go to his funeral and say Uncle Kevin was a good guy, and you gloss over the, you know, his personal shortcomings. When we're talking about a guy who has the most important job in the world and is engaging in policy choices that affect millions, if not billions, of people, I think a different set of rules apply. I don't think you need to gloss over, you know, choices they made in their lives that really did people harm.
So we could have been critical the day after.
Well, I mean, I think that the dictate that you don't speak ill of the dead, I think that works when you're talking about
Uncle Kevin.
But I think we, as historians, if we're, you know, reviewing George Herbert Walker Bush or John McCain or whoever it is, I don't think there's a period or a window, you know, immediately after their death, where we are supposed to sort of analyze them differently. If we were doing a podcast about the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush a month before he died...
Yes, I've been saying George W. Bush, I'm sorry. Yeah, George W. Bush. Yes.
George W. Bush is still alive as of recording this podcast. He's painting something somewhere in Texas. You know, if we'd recorded it before he died, we would be, I think, unflinchingly honest. And I think if we recorded a month after he died, I think we'd be unflinchingly honest. I think it's odd that you'd want to have a particular window, you know, having respect for the family, all these kinds of things. I think that applies for private citizens, not for public figures.
Okay.
But at least that's the rule.
No. I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable position, and I'm broadly sympathetic with it. As I said, I was interested in the coverage of George H.W. Bush's death, which was over the top hagiographic, I thought. But then I thought, and then there was a pretty sharp backlash in certain corners of the Twittersphere, really, and podcasts. And I'm just interested in the question of timing rather than context. I mean, it's interesting. So, when Bill Clinton dies, for example, do we lead with Juanita Broderick and say, well, the guy might have been a rapist? Is that how you begin your discussion? Or, you know, a lot of dog whistle racism in his campaign, and both when he ran for president and the campaign against Barack Obama in 2008. Do we lead with that?
I don't think you necessarily have to, you know, I think you lead with the fact he's a complicated guy. There's this sort of amnesia that you have over part of somebody's life, you know, I just remember when Nixon died, you know, there was a sort of week after Nixon's died, you know, the period between his death and his funeral where people were talking about, oh, he's this great statesman and foreign, you know,
policy expert and all these other kinds of things. And the fact that he, you know, tried to subvert democracy kind of got eluded. And, you know, I think the same thing is true for President Bush. If you, you know, he did lots of things that are remarkable in terms of holding various public offices, president, vice president, head of the CIA, he was in Congress, all this kind of stuff. Good. But the fact that his policy choices probably contributed to the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans from AIDS because his administration and the administration that preceded it when he was vice president made conscious choices to not tackle the AIDS crisis. I think, you know, you got to, and, you know, the racial politics of his presidency, I think both those things need to be looked at the same time. And I don't think you need to lead with one story or the other necessarily.
Okay, so, so
most public figures are complicated. Right. I think so you need to lead with the fact they're complicated.
So no time limit then.
That's my reading of it. But okay. All right.
Sorry. We often talk about the fact that I'm considerably older than you. So when you do your tribute podcast to me after my demise, David,
are you planning on retiring and dying?
I just want to know whether I'm Uncle Kevin or...
We'll be unflinchingly nice. I will leave it to your children to tell you the real version. I have no hesitation to think that they would... give the unvarnished truth.
I have no idea where we are in our
All right, well, so I got my number two. One of the things that I think was really striking about 2018 is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Frederick Douglass. This was recognized in a number of ways. There was a biography, a long-way biography, another sort of speaking of slow scholarship, but really good scholarship as a consequent, David Blight's biography of Frederick Douglass, a great book by our colleague Celeste Marie Bernier, also on Frederick Douglass, and a plaque that I passed on my way here today for the period of time which Frederick Douglass lived in Edinburgh.
Yes, I live on the same street as Frederick Douglass. Yes,
well, you know, he's a neighbor. And I think it was a very interesting anniversary to have this year. Obviously, he's becoming more and more known. Frederick Douglass.
He's doing great things.
He's doing great things. I do not know Douglass's biography. Blight's biography of Douglass is one of the things that President Obama recommended from reading from this year. So that's a probably more strong endorsement than mine. I think that was a very interesting anniversary to have in the midst of all the other things politically that have been going on. To think about Douglass's life and what it means 200 years on.
Great, great. My number one is related to your number one, I think.
Okay.
So I don't know whether you want to begin with yours or whether I should begin with mine. I mean, yours is specific, mine is more general.
Why don't you go with yours?
Well, mine is I want to call people's attention to an essay that appeared in Smithsonian, the magazine, in the December issue. So it's the most recent issue, by Brian Palmer and Seth Fried Wessler. And it's called The Cost of the Confederacy. And Palmer and Wessler have actually looked at, they spent a lot, it's a long read, it's worth reading. They spent a lot of time, they did public record searches. They found out how much money taxpayers spend to support Confederate monuments and institutions and museums around the country. And over the past decade, more than $40 million of public money has been spent on Confederate monuments. They tallied, and they suspect that's probably, they probably missed things as well. Mm. They make three main points in this essay. One is, and two of these will be well known, I think, to historians, and we've discussed monuments at some length, so we don't need to belabor it today, but they were created by Jim Crow governments as monuments to white supremacy. I mean, we've discussed that. We know that. Mm-hmm. Second, they did so in the face of active opposition at the time, often from African Americans. And mm-hmm. so, in other words, these monuments were controversial then when they were erected as well as now. And so one of their points is the kind of opposition to them now is not a fit of political correctness. That's doing an injustice to historic tradition, but rather it's in keeping with historic tradition. And their third point is this figure of $40 million spent on keeping monuments up or maintaining them or, you know, given to museums over the past 10 years.
So kind of puts a figure on a lot of... We've talked about monuments at some length over the course of the year, so I don't think we need to belabor it. But
So my big story from 2018 is the very long saga of Silent Sam, which I've talked about in the podcast before. This is the statue of a Confederate soldier that graces the entrance to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where I went to graduate school. It's been a controversial monument for years. And it was toppled by a group of students and activists earlier this year, dropped off of its pedestal and carted off to a secure and enclosed location. And there's been debates going on recently about what's going to happen to this monument now that it's off its pedestal. There was a proposal put forward by part of the university to build a special museum for it at the cost of some ridiculous amount of money. I want to say it's like $5 million. And that proposal eventually got shot down after a tremendous amount of public criticism that the university would be essentially building a monument to white supremacy. But I think...
Another monument
to white supremacy. Well, yes, they're taking... But yeah, this one would have a security guard and who knows. It was an awful idea. But I think, you know, the debate over Silent Sam that's been going on for years and the controversy that's been playing out throughout this year, I think has been a really interesting case study about the role of these monuments and the ways in which different communities of interests have claim upon it. So the students have a certain set of claims upon it, and obviously students aren't speaking with one voice on this, although it seems as if one voice is considerably larger than the other on that. The faculty and staff of the university, there's the broader community, there's the entire state which claims to have some bearing on the statue. And so I think it's an interesting place to think about historical memory and how we deal with the past. And so it's still an ongoing story. We'll see what happens with this statue. But that's my number one story for 2018, because I've been hoping that statue has come down and it's finally down.
Have you seen, there was a story that just came out in Vanity Fair where they were interviewing conservative women on campus.
Oh, no, I've not seen this.
Well, and the women they interviewed were at UNC, Chapel Hill.
Oh, geez, okay.
And so these were young white women who were in college Republicans and things like this, who claimed that they're persecuted on campus. You should have a look at it. As somebody who knows UNC, and Silent Sam comes up in this context because they're not happy about Silent Sam.
I can imagine.
And they were kind of Caitlin and Cammy and
we don't want to be prejudicial about their
I'm
names.
I'm saying what their names were. I'm not being prejudicial at all.
Okay.
Both, actually, Caitlin and Cammy both had Scottish surnames, but anyway, I'll leave it at that.
All right. So that's 2018.
And then we're looking forward, right?
Yes, we're looking forward. So 2019, what is the...
Several things, and we've gone on for a while, I'll be quick. I'm really looking forward to Robert Mueller's report.
You and me both.
Which I hope will come out in 2019, and yes. I think it will make very interesting reading, and I think we'll spend some time talking about it. We haven't done our big episode on Watergate yet, but I think we'll be doing one in 2019. So I'm looking forward to that. As you know, I've been on leave, and I have a fellowship at Monticello, which I'm enjoying very much, and I'm looking forward to going back to Charlottesville in a couple weeks' time. And continuing work on my book. But after that, I'm really looking forward to returning to teaching, because I've been missing teaching and missing the students. So,
and they miss you, Frank.
Yeah, well. And so I'm looking forward to that. So those are three things I'm looking forward to.
All right.
What about you, David?
Oh, I've got dozens of things I'm looking forward to. But I will spare listeners all of them. But just a few things, just a few books that I'm really looking forward to, some of which came out in late 2018, which I haven't gotten to yet. One of those is Pete Carmichael's A War for the Common Soldier, which looks at Civil War soldiers and motivations and sort of the lived experience of common soldiers in the Civil War. I'm really looking forward to reading that. That just came out a few weeks ago, but I haven't had a chance with marking the end of semester stuff to get to that yet. I'm really looking forward to Kevin Cruz and Julian Zelzer's Fault Lines, which is the history of the United States since Watergate. So thinking about Watergate. This is a period where we both kind of think we understand it because we lived through most of it, but I'm not sure that I do. And I'm really looking forward to reading that to sort of actually get a real historical take that's based on archival stuff and not based on sort of the gloss in the news.
Or thinking you know it.
Yes, exactly. Because there's a lot of the stuff that we feel that we know because we lived through it, but I'm not sure that we do. There's some books that are coming out later in 2019 I'm really interested in. Kevin Levin's Searching for Black Confederates, which is about the myth of Black Confederates. There's this sort of right-wing neo-Confederate idea that African-Americans fought for the Confederacy, and therefore the Confederacy wasn't really about racism or slavery, and therefore they can celebrate their Confederate ancestors as much as they want. It's based on misreading records. It's based on fabrications and Kevin's...
And it's sort of a parallel trope with the white slaves.
Yeah, exactly. And often those two things are paired together, right? And so, but Kevin has looked at this for a number of years and trying to piece together sort of different versions of this myth and where they've come from. And so I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to Stephanie McCurry's book on women in the Civil War, which is coming out, I believe, in April or May. And she's a really an extraordinary historian. She's written a couple of books on the Confederacy and on... gender, and this book I think is really going to be sort of capstone of a really extraordinary career looking at that. And I am looking forward to going to the United States in April to do a bit of a research trip book tour for the... I've never gone on a book tour before. So I'm going to be speaking about this book I have coming out in April on surrender and the Civil War. And I'm going throughout the Carolinas and Virginia and Georgia and DC area, doing some talks about that book and doing some research for this book I'm working on the environmental history of slavery.
I will see you in Charlottesville.
Yeah, you're gonna be heckling me from the back of the back of the audience.
Boo!
All right.
Anyway, Happy New Year, Dave.
Yes, Happy New Year. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.